Sit back, relax, and take a ride with us on the Gunblog Variety Cast, Episode 7. Back to the Gunblog Variety Cast. I'm your host, Sean, from NC Gunblog, and with me today is Adam from Guns, Cars, Tech Blog. How are you doing, Adam?
I am so sleepy.
So, for those of you who don't know, my wife is now 9 months pregnant, and we're not sleeping hardly at all.
So, oh, great.
Any minute now.
Well, let's jump right into it then, see if we can get this done, get you back to bed. We're going to start with a tactical dog and fitness report. What's going on with you, Adam?
So, I mentioned that my dog is kind of a fatty. Well, after 3 weeks of walking 3 miles a day and green bean goodness is what we like to call it, where we replaced a lot of our food with zero calorie green beans, she actually gained 2 pounds. So I'm going in the wrong direction.
Well, you know, maybe I need to get your dog to teach my dog to eat a little more.
Yeah. You were mentioning that.
Yeah. Well, I've just hit, as of a day or two ago, 2,000 dog walking miles since August of last year.
Wow.
And by the time this podcast goes live, and we've moved to a release time of Sunday night, by the time this goes out live, I'll be at 2,000 miles on my bicycle.
That's pretty awesome.
Yep, that's pretty cool. And now it's time for that bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, Aaron Paulette. Aaron wants to talk about Ebola. Aaron, Ebola's gone airborne. We're all going to die. What are we going to do, Aaron?
The first thing to do is not panic.
Not panic. Not panic.
Okay,
I can do that.
Panicking.
I cannot panic.
Not panicking.
Oh, wait. Not panicking.
All right. So what I'm going to do with this segment is I'm going to give you a little bit of history of Ebola, what it is, how it works, why it isn't quite so terrible, and what you can do to protect yourself against it. So as you may have heard, there has been a confirmed case of Ebola in Dallas. I really don't want to fan any flames of panic. So I'm giving you this information just so you know what's going on. Ebola is a virus that comes from Western Africa. It, so far as we know, comes from fruit bats. And they eat some fruit, and they get their saliva on the fruit. And other animals eat the fruit. They contract it. Humans go and kill these animals for the meat. They eat the meat, and it gets into their bloodstream. Once a human has it, the transmission between humans is really very close to how AIDS is transmitted. So if you grew up in the 80s with the AIDS scare, you're already really prepared for this sort of thing because it comes by transmission with fluids, blood, saliva, things like that, or exposure to personal items like bed sheets or clothing or handkerchiefs that have been used by the infected person. There's some discussion as to whether or not Ebola is airborne. Right now, the safest thing to assume is this. If you are in the same room with someone who has Ebola, you're not going to get it just by breathing their air. But if they sneeze, and especially if you've got, you know, an open wound, or, you know, you walk into the cloud, it could get in through your mucous membranes. So, obviously, you don't want to be sneezed on. The neat thing about Ebola, in as much as there is a neat thing, is that when someone is contagious, they look sick. So you don't have to worry about someone who looks fine but could give it to you anyway. You'll know they're sick. So just stay away from sick-looking people, and you'll be all right. So the average time between contracting the disease and showing the symptoms is about 8 to 10 days on average. Could be as little as 2, could be as much as 21. And the initial symptoms are a lot like the flu. And the typical bleeding that you associate with Ebola, hence the hemorrhagic and hemorrhagic fever, that usually begins 5 to 7 days after your initial symptoms.
So you're contagious when you have flu-like symptoms.
Yes, exactly.
Flu season's about to start.
Yeah, oh, I'm about to get to that.
Okay.
So the good news, like I said, is that they aren't contagious until they look sick. The bad news here is that the virus can stay dangerous for a couple of days to a week after the host is dead, especially if the temperatures are cold. You really need to be careful about cleaning up after them. So here's what you can do to keep yourself safe from Ebola. Just like Adam said, get a flu shot, because not only will having a flu shot protect you from getting the flu, which last time I checked is a much bigger killer than Ebola is, but it will also serve as a big indicator to yourself and to the doctor if you start to develop flu-like symptoms anyway. So if you got a shot, you're still starting to feel bad, go see the doctor just in case. Now, it's uncertain if insects can transmit the disease. Just to be safe, if you are in an area where someone has contracted Ebola, use mosquito repellent when you go outside. Check thoroughly for ticks on yourself, your family, and your pets. And if you have pets, hire a service to spray for fleas within your home. Again, we don't know if it's spread through insect bites, but this is a case of better safe than sorry. Next thing you can do, be very mindful of where your food comes from. Make sure it's washed thoroughly. Make sure it's cooked well. Like I mentioned before, practice safe sexual procedures, because it's spread through fluids, and you know what fluids I'm talking about. Now, the last part is things you can buy. There are kits you can buy to protect yourself for a contagion. And they're usually like a Tyvek bodysuit, the booties, the rubber gloves, the N95 mask, goggles, things like that. If you feel the need to go out and get one, that's great. I personally don't think you need one because, well, it's for two reasons. One, the main reason to have this is if you are dealing with a sick person or cleaning up the mess. And if that happens, you should not be doing this. This is the sort of thing you leave to the medical professionals who have the training, who have much better medical gear than you have access to, and are constantly monitored for being sick. My recommendation, if you feel like you absolutely must go out and buy something, is that you go out and you buy food, water, and other supplies like toilet paper in case you need to quarantine yourself inside your home. I'd go for about 6 weeks worth of supplies because it's much easier to protect your house and make your house and everyone inside it germ-free than it is to dress up in disposable gear every time you go outside, and then when you come back, you have to throw away all the gear, wash yourself down with disinfectant or hand sanitizer, wash your clothes in hot water. This is a lot of work. If you're so worried about infection, I think your best bet is really just to stay home, secure it, and wait out the disease.
I think that's really good advice.
Excellent. So I'll stop panicking, and I appreciate all the information. So we'll see you next week. If you'd like to read more from Erin, check out her on her blog and her group blog, bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com. Now it's time for some felons behaving badly.
Oh, that never happens.
No. Fayetteville police have arrested a man and charged him with killing a cyclist from New York. That's a bicyclist, not a motorcyclist.
Mm-hmm.
Multiple media outlets reported that 32-year-old suspect of Fayetteville was arrested Sunday and charged with first-degree murder, first-degree kidnapping, armed robbery, and conspiracy. It's not clear if the suspect has an attorney. He is charged in the death of 32-year-old Mark Boyd II of Islip. Is that Islip? Islip?
I think it's Islip.
All right, well, whatever it is, New York. The people from New York will know what I'm talking about on Thursday. Police accuse suspect of luring Boyd into a co-conspirator's car on the pretense of helping the victim find a hotel room. No other arrests have been reported. Police think the suspect and another man robbed Boyd, and then the suspect shot Boyd several times. Investigators said Boyd's bicycle, his saddlebag, a map, camping fuel, and personal items were stolen. Okay, now this hits pretty hard for me because one of these days I want to ride across the United States. And now I carry a gun, and I will continue to carry a gun. And I will carry a gun on the ride all the way across the United States, with the exception of a little section of Illinois and the state of Oregon so far. I can ride all the way across the United States and carry a gun. But how do you know that somebody isn't going to get the drop on you and murder you? That sort of thing makes me very angry.
Yeah.
So what sort of person do you think would lure a bicyclist into a car, rob him, and murder him?
Well, you know, they said that they offered to take him to a motel. So obviously it was a very good Samaritan who, had a Glock nearby and the death rays got to him.
Yeah, the brain rays. Yes. Right. Yes. Definitely. No, unfortunately, once again, He is a multiple felon. Two convictions, two counts of robbery with a dangerous weapon. Wow, it sounds kind of like what he did.
Yeah.
One I can't quite make out. ASI law probation something officer with duty. I'm assuming that is interfering with one of these sort of law enforcement officers in the course of their duty. Felony breaking and entering, misdemeanor breaking and entering, and driving under the influence. So exactly the sort of person that you and I know running around causing these sorts of crimes, and not the people that the anti-gunners are going to blame, us ordinary random concealed carriers.
Right, of course.
Well, Nikki's back, and she talked with me about our foreign military presence. Nikki, we've got people all over the world in bases in foreign countries. Why don't we just bring them home and stop getting involved in foreign entanglements?
Because, first of all, it's a bit unrealistic. So let's discuss some of the realities here. So number one, we have been closing bases all over the world since before the 90s. You know, especially since we won the Cold War, we've started closing quite a few military installations overseas. There were a bunch in Germany when I was stationed there, a bunch in Japan and Italy, etc. So why do we need to eliminate our presence in foreign countries? Why? It's not a realistic demand at all. Number one, it's important that we maintain some presence overseas. We use bases overseas as staging areas. We're also still a big part of the NATO alliance. And as a matter of fact, in that alliance, our defense spending constitutes more than 70% of the total NATO spending. That is a big deal. Also, you know, despite what a lot of libertarians say, the NATO alliance is actually still very, very relevant, especially when you look at what Russia's been doing this year, as far as, you know, threatening its neighbors and resurging and rebuilding and building up its military and spending tons and tons of money to rebuild its military. It's pretty crazy. Our presence in Europe deters adversaries. Our presence in Japan is also a hedge against possible Chinese aggression. Eastern Europe, those bases are relatively inexpensive. We don't have a whole lot of them. And we don't have a whole lot of people there, but they are actually closer to potential hotspots in the Middle East and also Central Asia. And again, a hedge against Russian aggression, which we can see has been fairly a big deal this year. So we'll use a lot of these different facilities to as kind of staging facilities to surge men and equipment toward the world's hotspots. Guantanamo, you know, we have the prison there. It's a logistical base for the Navy. It's a hub for counter-drug operations in which the military is getting more and more involved, especially because drugs are being trafficked by some very, very nasty people in the world. And frankly, you know, we also have an interest in ensuring a safe world. It's a different world nowadays. We're very economically connected. You know, the EU is our number one trading partner. We have an economic interest in ensuring a secure world with whom we trade. And additionally, you know, it's also a troop training thing. When I deployed to Kosovo a few years back, our training environment was actually on a military training facility in Hohenfels, Germany. It was cheap and it was there, and the terrain was very similar to where we were going. So it was a really, really good training environment. Also because, you know, right now we're kind of in an economic slump, and closing down all the bases is actually a huge short and medium term expense.
What bases do we have open right now, and what are they used for?
We still have a good amount of bases. We have bases in Germany. We have troops stationed in Germany. Obviously, you know, for logistical purposes, if there's a resurgent Russia, if there's, you know, trouble in the Middle East, we have troops in Europe. We have troops in Turkey, in Incirlik, Turkey. We have air bases there. We have troops at Lajes Field in Portugal, and they also support transiting aircraft. We have air bases in Aviano, Italy. We have We have bases in Spain. There's strategic locations for NATO aircraft. And we actually run, you know, training exercises and missions with our NATO allies. So we do have bases all over Europe. We have, obviously, a military presence still in Okinawa. We still have a military presence in Korea. A lot smaller military footprint worldwide than it used to be.
How does having American troops in foreign hotspots deter foreign aggression?
It's actually very simple. It's a huge psychological deterrent. There's a difference between a foreign adversary attacking its neighbors and knowing that it's just its neighbors that are going to react, as opposed to a foreign adversary knowing that they're going to engage in a direct conflict with the United States. We are, despite budget cuts and despite a lot of issues, still the primary military force in the world. We are the biggest, we are the best trained, we are a very, very tough military force. So having us in a particular area and knowing that we will get involved is a huge deterrent to potential adversaries, because they understand that they're going to have to deal with the premier military force in the world.
All right, Nikki, I'm glad you were able to come back and hope to see you again soon.
Bye.
Well, Nikki blogs at thelibertyzone.com. Like we talked about last week, we are going to talk about some of the strange firearms laws we see in other states. And I thought it would be fun to break out one of my favorites from my old home state of Pennsylvania, the license to carry firearms. The license to carry firearms, which is what in any other state would be a concealed handgun permit or a concealed handgun
right.
license.
Right.
Pennsylvania calls it a license to carry firearms.
Okay.
Well, a license to carry firearms in Pennsylvania is as a result of the law that says firearms not to be carried without a license. Right.
Okay.
Pennsylvania is an open carry state. You can open carry a pistol, and as long as you're not in the city of Philadelphia, a city of the first class, you can carry without a license. Philadelphia being special in more than one way. Whenever they write a law, they also have to define their terms.
Yep.
Right. It's except as provided in paragraph 2, any person who carries a firearm in any vehicle, or any person who carries a firearm concealed on or about his person, except in his place of abode or fixed place of business, without a valid and lawfully issued license under this chapter, commits a felony in the third degree.
Oh.
You know, it goes on to say that if you're actually eligible to have a license to carry firearms and you do it without the license, it's lesser problem than if you're not eligible.
Gotcha. Okay.
The problem is, what's a firearm?
Oh, that's a good question. What is a firearm?
What is a firearm? Well, funny enough, in Title 18, which is what this is under, firearm is any pistol or revolver with a barrel length less than 15 inches. This is starting to sound familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Any shotgun with a barrel length less than 18 inches, or any rifle with a barrel length less than 16 inches, or any pistol, revolver, rifle, or shotgun with an overall length of less than 26 inches. And then it goes on to define how you measure the barrel.
Okay.
That is a firearm.
That's
guess what's not a
interesting.
Firearm?
Interesting. Shotguns and rifles are not firearms.
Right. If you have a shotgun with a 18-inch barrel or a 20-inch barrel, it's not a firearm. Not according to Title 18, not under the criminal code. If you have a rifle, like my AR-15 has a 16-inch barrel on it, that's not a firearm under Title 18. So that means that I can't carry it concealed. Now, how I'm going to conceal that, I don't know. What it also means is I can't carry it loaded in a vehicle. But if I was to, say, get a short-barreled rifle,
mm-hmm.
then I could carry it loaded as my truck gun and use that as, you know, personal defense weapon in a vehicle, and I could carry it loaded in the vehicle under a license to carry firearms. And if I had a big long trench coat and I could figure out how to conceal the stupid thing, I could carry it underneath my trench coat and it would be perfectly legal.
What if you had a 15 and a half inch AR barrel and then you put the SIG brace on the back so you had a 15 and a half inch pistol?
Is it less than 26 inches overall?
Oh, actually, yes, it would be 25 and a half.
There you go. That's how it gets in. It's under 26 inches.
Huh.
So yeah, that was always one of the funny ones, and I've one of these days I'm you know when I'm wealthy I'm gonna get my dad an AR-15 short barreled rifle, it's chambered in 9mm, put a suppressor on it, and that's going to be my, I'm going to give that to my dad as his truck gun. He carried that around. If he ever has to, defend himself on the street, he can haul out his loaded 9mm short-barreled AR-15 with a suppressor. Take care
Good
of business.
Times.
Good Take
times.
Care of business. I also got to speak with Miguel about the monopoly on killing. Miguel, what is this monopoly on killing you're talking about?
A monopoly on killing is the principle that the government are the only ones that are legally allowed to kill a human being. So the legal homicide is only exercised by the government and nobody else.
Well, isn't that true?
Yes and no. Yes, it is for most countries in the world. And of course, there's this country that decides to go against the grain and no such thing happens, which is the United States. The problem with the monopoly on killing is that by itself, it will deny you the right of self-defense. In many countries, actually, you go to almost every country around the world and tell you, yeah, you have the right to life and the right to defend your life, but they will, on principle, deny you the tools to defend yourself. You know, basically a gun.
Well, one of the things I've said for a long time is that we're having the wrong argument here. We're having the argument over whether we should have guns or shouldn't have guns when they're avoiding the real argument, which is there any circumstance in which an ordinary citizen, not an employee of the government, has the right to kill another human being? And that answer has always been yes to me. If somebody is trying to kill you, it's perfectly okay for you to use deadly force to stop them from doing that.
For many countries, you have no right to kill anybody else. They give false value on life. They'll tell you that, you know, every life is sacred and you shouldn't kill. You're the life of the mass killer, you know, decapitating babies. It's as good as yours. So he is supposed to be given a chance. Of course, you know, they are not telling you anything about the lives of the babies that are being killed at that precise moment. But it's just a stupid legality to keep the majority of the people in a country under the control of the government.
Under this view that I don't have the right to kill another person, if I don't have that right and you don't have that right and none of the people that live in this country have that right, then where does the government, which merely represents us, get that right?
Well, supposedly that's a social contract we allegedly make with the government. We give our government the power to kill an individual or several individuals within very strict parameters. If we have individuals coming from outside our countries to do us harm, the government trusts a certain amount of people dressed in camo and with the rifles and grenades and tanks and whatever to go ahead and do killing to protect the country, to protect us. If the enemy is inside, is a criminal, is a killer, is a rapist, we entrust a group of people dressed in blue called police within very strict parameters. You can go ahead and confront that person with a deadly weapon and use deadly force if necessary. But we also have is that we don't believe in the monopoly on killing. We don't have that in the United States. Therefore, if you as a regular person also are faced with somebody that will do you harm, great bodily harm, it's gonna kill you, you have the right to use deadly force to kill that person.
In what circumstance, though, does a group of people have a right that a single person doesn't have? I can't think of one. If I don't have that right and you don't have that right, then the two of us together still don't have that right. And no matter how many of our friends we get together, we still don't have that right. So the government can't say, well, we have the right to kill people and you don't, because, well, that's just nonsensical.
Exactly. But like I said, it's supposed to be constrained in between very specific details. Not better, not worse than anybody else.
Exactly.
But what happens is, number one, we have agreed on that, and that thing, that we have something that's called the Constitution. We have a very good set of rules for that one, even though people fail to comply with those rules sometimes. And we have the means to change those people that are in power. Like I said, but that happens here in the States. Because from the get-go, we ignore this thing that we have to retreat, that we have to let the government decide for us. The people went, bull, hell, where are you? You are, you know, in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, you are days, months away to come do something for me. If nowadays we complain that police take too long to get us in, to come help us, and we're talking about matters of minutes, imagine in the 1800s where, you know, a judge may show up once every 3 months.
Exactly. We make a deal with the government. We give up our right to private vengeance, and in exchange, the government provides us public justice.
Exactly.
That means that I don't go down the street and enforce the law, even though I have the right to go and take my property back. I call the government and say, hey, come out here and enforce this law for me. And we've decided as a society that that makes sense. We don't want brawls in the street over property. But that doesn't negate my right as a human being to live long enough to receive that public justice.
Exactly. It's been a social contract that has been working wonderful. Look at, you know, other nations that don't have that social contract, in which the government does have the monopoly on killing. What happens is the good people will respect the law. Good people will say, well, you know, if it's understandable, I don't have the monopoly in killing, therefore I don't need to have weapons to defend myself because the government has put on itself to defend me. We know reality. Reality is, you know, it's a whole different thing. So all of a sudden we have a group of what's called criminals that do not care about the monopoly of killing. They understand that the government cannot be in anywhere, and they face themselves, you know, with this gigantic pool of victims, and they're going to go after it. And even if it's not a criminal, but people that want to have power, control a government, control a nation, I've decided, you know, that I will massacre half a nation, be it by machetes or like they did in Rwanda, or starvation like they did in Somalia, because they cannot stand up to me. And the government is not strong enough to defend it. Itself or defend its people. So we're basically, what we're doing when they say, you know, oh, we need to have a monopoly in killing only for the government, is we are setting ourselves for massacres, for crime, and, you know, basically death.
All right, so you had a book that you wanted to tell me about.
Oh, yeah. If you guys want to read about how the coming of Stand Your Ground laws and where it comes from and how old the concept of standing your ground is, there's a book, it's called No Duty to Retreat, by Richard Maxwell Brown. Be advised, people, this guy does not like the Second Amendment, does not like the right to defend yourself. He thinks it's, you know, it's barbarian, it's stupid, but he does a wonderful job at tracing the history of the concept of self-defense in the United States. I mean, he would love every state of the Union go to full unity retreat to the extreme, in what is called, you know, going all the way up to the wall, and still you might be prosecuted.
All right, Miguel, it was good to see you again this week, and we'll see you again next week.
Okay, have a great one.
Well, get more Miguel Gonzalez Daily at gunfreezone.net. Fun with headlines. I hear you got a road rage incident for us.
Well, that's what the headline says, and that's kind of what the story says, but not really. So the headline here is Road Rage Incident Creates Potential Danger, which is kind of a Captain Obvious. Well, yeah. Okay, sure. I'm not going to read the article because it's kind of lengthy. And if you go to the show notes, there's the article and there's also a video. If you watch the video and you read the article, you'll see that, well, it was just really two teenagers acting like idiots.
Yeah, because that never happens. Teenagers don't act like idiots.
Yeah, so basically, there was a woman coming from one direction, and these two teenagers in separate cars were coming from the other direction, and one of them made a left turn, and the other one slammed on his brakes and hit a telephone pole.
Right.
And that was, and then the
and then the first the one left that, the scene.
And then the first one left. And that was the, oh my gosh, potential road rage incident.
Wait. Road rage incident creates potential danger. Right.
Yeah.
The car hit a telephone pole and flipped over. That's not potential danger. That's real danger.
No. The potential danger was for the woman who witnessed this accident, because she was scared that they were going to, you know, come across the double yellow line and hit her.
Because that's the important thing. They've got a car flipped over, stuck on a telephone pole, and now we're worried that maybe it could have possibly have hurt her in the process.
Yes. She had her six-year-old. Yeah. Anyway.
I think this one made the news because we had a photogenic mommy who had a good story.
Yes, I completely agree with that.
Because she's photogenic. She's very
attractive. She is. She is.
Potential danger, though.
Potential.
Flipped over car, stuck on a telephone pole is a potential danger.
Yes, potential.
Who knew?
Right. Editors.
Oh, well, you're selling eyeballs. You got to attract them.
That's right.
Well, in our tech tip segment today, Baron Gets Cryptic. Baron, I have an iPhone, and I hear Apple is thinking about making them more secure so the government can't just get in and take them. The government can do that?
There's a lot of history behind this. The first piece of history is back in the 90s, there was a big kerfuffle around pretty good privacy, otherwise known as PGP encryption. At the time, the government was classifying it as a munition. Long story short, the guy was smart, published it in a book, put it in the Library of Congress, and brought the book out and said, look, you can't get me for exporting munition because it's already published in a book. Saved his bacon, but ever since, they have still consistently gone after people, gone after companies more specifically, to force them to put backdoors in their software. The biggest example of this would be Cisco. Cisco, with their voice over IP phones, actually properly did the security as best as they could, and the FBI said, no, you can't do that. We have to have a way to be able to wiretap these. We want you to install a backdoor. Lo and behold, a couple years later, the backdoor is discovered, and now not only can the FBI wiretap your Cisco voice over IP phone, but everyone and their mother who knows the backdoor can do it as well. So what's changed? Well, the market has grossly changed. For example, you and I and everyone else have become considerably more aware of the government being able to go in and pry open things that they shouldn't be allowed to pry open without a warrant and really needing some sort of cause to go through the effort of doing so. Previously, they just walk up and tell Apple, hey, we want to look inside this person's phone, and Apple will go, okay, here you go. And now it's, well, we can't. And Apple, with their latest iOS 8 updates, has shifted their key modeling, so quite literally, Apple cannot open your phone. They can't. There's two keys involved. There's the key you know, and then there's another key that's internal to the phone. And if that key is lost, it's done. And so without that second key, which Apple has no idea about, there's no way they can get it, apart from finding other exploits in the phone and design of the system as a whole. So what it boils down to is everyone has now entered the same playing field. Apple, the government, the mafia, everyone. Everyone has just entered the same field. And this, to me, is actually a very, very good thing. And I really want Apple to win. Apple, I'm glad to see Apple taking the lead because we need somebody with deep pockets to go fight this, and they're fighting the good fight. I used to hate Apple with a passion. I still kind of jokingly refer to them as being a trendsetter type market, but at the same time, their operating system for, you know, OS X by far is actually one of the best Unixes I've used as a desktop. And when they come in and they start fighting this fight, and they're doing things that quite honestly are the right thing to do, it makes me very, very happy. Google always has the slogan of do no evil. If that was really the case, they would be out in front leading this charge, and I'm kind of disappointed they're not.
Why does the government insist on putting backdoors and things in the first place?
Because they're lazy.
Because they're lazy?
Yes, because they're lazy. Because in the grand scheme, all things considered, there are plenty of vulnerabilities that already exist throughout software that we shouldn't be going and willfully creating more. Because eventually they will be found. They will be found by somebody we don't want finding them, such as a foreign nation that is going to exploit that vulnerability against us, a criminal enterprise who's going to exploit that vulnerability against people so that they can steal money from their bank accounts. It really doesn't serve anyone other than the government to add this known backdoor. And it only serves the government because that way they know the key. They don't have to go find a key to get in. And the best example in this past week that has come about and how there are serious issues that already exist well throughout systems is shell shock. For those who don't know, shell shock is a very serious vulnerability in the Bash shell that can allow somebody to fully compromise a system up to whatever the execution privileges are for that bash shell. So if that shell is running as root, they literally own the system.
All right. In English, what you just said was that anybody who has this problem on their computer, and that's basically everything that runs in Unix.
Any kind of star NIX. If it's any flavor of the Unix system, you probably have bash and you are affected.
And basically that means that anybody who knows how to exploit it can then do anything they want with your computer, including delete everything or watch everything you do.
That is correct.
And this wasn't intentional?
This was not intentional. They traced it back as far as they could, and they saw that it existed in a copy of the source code from 1989.
In computer years, that's like forever.
In computer years, that is pretty much at the dawn of the dinosaur.
Any further back, and they're going to find it in punch cards.
Correct.
So what you're saying is there's no real point in putting a backdoor in anything because there already exist all kinds of vulnerabilities that it would be nice if we knew they existed, but if they put some effort into finding them, they could be doing us a service. They could maybe tell us about these exploits.
Yes, they could tell us about these exploits, they could tell us about the problems, and we could go fix it. We could learn. It could become a mutual exchange of information. Instead, what we have today is basically an arms race with one side racing against the other. And if that's the game they want to play, we shouldn't be providing them their own munitions to lob into this side of the fence.
Well, in my opinion, putting a backdoor in my computer is the same thing as putting a backdoor into my house. If you own the key to come walk into my house anytime that you want, then I don't have a Fourth Amendment.
And I fully and wholeheartedly sympathize with that statement.
All right, Baron. Well, see you next week.
See you next week.
Well, Baron still blogs at the-minuteman.org. So I hear you had a bit of a scope failure.
Regular readers of my blog will remember that back in March, I put together a Remington 700 at 308 with a suppressor on it and a Millet TRS-1 scope on top. I put that rifle together specifically to go to a shoot in East Tennessee in March and barely made it. Got out there, hadn't zeroed the rifle yet, and spent about an hour and probably 50 rounds trying to get it zeroed, and we just couldn't make it happen. So then I had to go and send off the rifle for the recall. Got it back. So this last Monday, yeah, like everybody else,
they're not getting my rifle back. I'm happy with my rifle.
Yeah, well, just drop in a Timney trigger and recall is not a problem. But so I got it back, finally got it all put together, took off work on Monday, went out to the 300-yard range that we have here locally with a friend of mine, and tried to get it zeroed. Well, we started off at 50 yards, had a nice about 3/4-inch group at 50 yards, but it was low and to the left. So I started cranking the scope over to the right, and it didn't move. My group didn't move. So eventually what we did was we put it in a gun vise, looked through it, zeroed it. Looked through the scope, turned the turned the target turret, and the reticle didn't move at all. So that reticle is busted. I got to send it back. Luckily, Millet has a lifetime warranty. They're made by Bushnell.
Oh, that's good.
So more warranty work on my rifle.
Well, Weird hauls out an old bit of yellow journalism by 2020 titled, If I Only Had a Gun. Weird. 2020 did an expose on concealed carry on campus where they grabbed a couple of students and they said, hey, here's a gun. Let's see how good you are at defending yourself. What did you think of that?
Oh, this was a good one. This is an older one, but this is kind of like the Kellerman study. It's old, but the antis just hold on to it just as tight as they can be because they think this is the magic holy grail against people concealed carrying. Their essential rules are, you know what? You can carry concealed, but it's just not going to work. It's kind of like the, oh, no, don't carry a gun. They'll just take it away and use it against you. And it wasn't true at all.
Talk us through some of the things that you saw in the video that just didn't make sense to you.
First up, the students were all untrained. They weren't people that had concealed carry. carry permits. There weren't people that regular carried. Some of them were shooters, but most of them weren't. And they were going up against a police marksman.
What they said was, is in Pennsylvania has no training requirement. They said, well, these students have had more training than is required by Pennsylvania, and so therefore they're better trained than most people who carry concealed. Would you think that that was true?
No, because, I mean, as a general rule, if you're going to choose to carry concealed, you're choosing to carry concealed. So obviously you've thought about it a little more than just the, hey, do you want to sign up for this thing that we're doing? Which is pretty much what they did. These were all essentially cold calls.
A lot of carrying a firearm is mental preparation. Thinking about what you would do in various situations, and it's the sort of thing that experience does tell. So what else did you see in the video?
We've got a police marksman, which I don't think is particularly indicative towards a mass shooter situation. I haven't seen a single one that shows that any of them were particularly proficient in firearms. Let's see, the gear that they gave them. They gave them a Glock pistol with simmunitions, and they gave them a retention-style holster that they wore at the 12 o'clock position, so right at their belt buckle. Then they gave them this crazy long floppy t-shirt to cover it. The thing went almost down to their thighs. Well, all the way down to their thighs. And that was their concealment garment. That meant for a particularly bad choice of draw and even concealment.
Exactly. So they had the wrong holster, they had the wrong clothing, and because they hadn't had any time to prepare, they got this sprung on them at the last second before they walked into the class. They were in the wrong mindset.
And then on top of that, the scenario was completely set up where the shooter knew exactly what he was doing. All the quote-unquote students in the classroom were all plants by 2020, and the shooter was sitting at front and center in the middle of the class, and that was the student that was supposedly concealed carrying was set dead center in the class, and that was the location that they were going to be at. The quote-unquote active shooter knew that. So everyone knew, they knew that there was only one gun in the classroom, and they knew exactly where that gun was.
Exactly. That student walked into the class and was forced to sit in the same chair. No matter what student it was, they always got this dead center right in the middle and right in the front row. They were forced into that chair. So when you watch the trained marksman come in, he kicked the door in, shot the teacher a couple of times, whirled, and the next shots were at the particular person he had to worry about.
Yep. It was all a script. It was all a very, very, very straightforward script. The marksman going in was going to shoot the teacher and then immediately turn towards his only other threat, which was the person there. And that's not how it works. And then on top of that, everybody else was also acting off of a script as well. So they were all behaving in ways that was told to them, not how they would do it. It was not like everybody was untrained people and all caught flat-footed. It was everybody else was there to make things more difficult for the defender.
That was one of the things that I noticed about it, in that if you ever see video of a school mass shooting, what you see is a whole bunch of people cowering under the desk waiting for somebody to come and shoot them. You don't see people jumping up and running in all directions and messing with the person who's doing the shooting. You see everybody flop down underneath their desk because that's what they're trained to do by their teachers.
Yeah. And then, of course, also there was one scenario where one of the quote unquote students sitting there also had a simmunition gun. And so when the person did engage the first shooter, the second one pulled out their gun and shot them. And this was someone who was sitting in the desk right beside them.
It really looked to me like that was insurance. Oh my, this girl looks like she might win. I better kill her from here before we look bad.
Yeah, it makes me wonder. That was actually the scenario that went best for the defender. I kind of wonder if that person with the gun, the secondary shooter, was there all the time, but they weren't going to make their presence known unless they were needed.
Yeah, exactly. It really did look like insurance.
And of course, also, the biggest thing on this is there was no winning solution and there was no proper mindset towards what was the end result on this. There was definitely times where both the attacker and the defender took shots, and that was considered a loss for the defender. But you also got to remember, there's all those other students in there. In an active shooter scenario, as soon as the active shooter finds any sort of resistance, that's when it all ends. So even if, you know, the good guy gets injured or killed, that's not necessarily a loss. It stinks in the case of that person, but they could have saved countless lives if it had been an actual active shooter scenario. So even their idea of a loss isn't necessarily true. It actually reminds me of last week's episode where Miguel talks about the Warsaw Ghetto. The people in the Warsaw Ghetto, you know, didn't fare that much better defending themselves against the Germans. But in the end, them tying up the German forces hurt the Germans overall. And overall, it was good for everyone that was against the Nazis in the war.
Yeah, it was.
That's a kind of a grim thing to think about. But it's, you know, it's a reality. And 2020 calling this saying, oh, you guys should never carry a firearm, you know, in defense of an active shooter situation, and you should just lay down and play dead. You know, they're not thinking this through.
They didn't take the one scenario that they could have taken, which was the scenario at Virginia Tech, where Colin Goddard, as Kurt Hoffman likes to call call him the Alchemist.
Man turns lead into gold.
He does. The Alchemist, his scenario proves right there that a concealed handgun permit holder would have worked, because the teacher heard noises, went out into the hallway and went, oh my, slams the door shut, yells at everybody to get down. Colin Goddard climbs onto the floor and pulls out his cell phone and starts dialing 911. I believe he said he actually connected with 911. Well, I'll tell you what, you can pull out your cell phone and I'll pull out my handgun. We'll see who gets up on target first.
Well, that's true. I can, no matter how deep concealment your gun is, you can get it out in the time it takes you to pull out a cell phone and dial 911. Any gunners believe that if you can develop a single scenario where a concealed carry holder can't win, that proves that there are no scenarios where they can win.
Yeah.
This is a typical straw man. You also see it with the, you say people with concealed carry permits are all law-abiding. No, nobody ever said that. They're the ones that make the claim that guns are the magic talisman. If the guns are to work, then you're always safe if you're carrying a firearm. And if you're ever not safe when you're carrying a firearm, then there's no sense in having them.
Right, but then, you know, asking them to have logic is pretty much asking pigs to fly, isn't it?
If they were logical, they'd be pro-gun.
That's true. All right, Weird, it's good to have you. See you next week.
All right, great to be on.
In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host on The Squirrel Report and blogs at weirdworld.com. That's W-E-E-R-D world.com. Stuff that grinds my gears. The metric system. And not just the metric system, but people who love the metric system. Because it's oh so scientific. It's not arbitrary. Like, we're not measuring ourselves by the length of the king's foot. Oh no.
Right.
We've got this very, very scientific length that we're now measuring things by. The meter.
Oh. Yes. And a meter is found in nature. Wait, where?
Where, exactly. Now, the metric system is based on two arbitrary things. Number one, the number of fingers you have on both hands. And number two, the distance from the equator to the North Pole at sea level divided by 10 million. Now, Who got out the tape measure and said, we're going to measure this? And guess what? It turns out that that's not actually the distance. That's the distance it would be if the Earth was exactly a sphere. But guess what? It's not.
So, yeah, it's a little fat in the middle.
So, you know, what's a foot? A foot is about, you know, hold your hands out, it's about that far. And what's a meter? Well, make it about three times as wide, and it's about that far. It's defined essentially as, you know, the length of a chunk of metal that they got in a museum in France. It's literally defined as the length of the path traveled by light in a vacuum during the time interval of 1 over 299,792 1,458ths of a second. How do you measure that?
Oh, wait, you mean you can't just like see that? You can't see the particles going over? Is that just me?
He made it up. Oh, it's so scientific. It's not arbitrary a bit. Yes, it is. And 10 is the most worthless base we have. The world would have been so much better if we'd all been born with 6 fingers on each hand. Because 12 is a wonderful number. 12 is the perfect number. You can divide it in half. You can divide it by 2. You can divide it by 3. You can divide it by 4. You can divide it by 6. It can be divided in so many ways. And guess how many inches there are in a foot? 12 of them!
Ah.
I would like to know how big 1/3 of a meter is. Be precise. Use your meter stick. Come on.
Oh, wait. That's 33.3, and then I got to draw a line over it.
Exactly. You got to interpolate a whole bunch of junk.
Yeah.
If the metric system was so brilliant, why don't we have metric hours? You got 10 minutes in them. Or 100 minutes. Or metric days. You got 10 hours. Or we can split it day and night. That'd be 20 hours with 100 minutes.
Don't tempt them.
Seriously. They're a bunch of idiots. Now, I can count to 10 because I've got that many fingers. I took different bases in math when I was in grade school. Yeah, you can do base 8. I didn't know what the heck I was going to do with base 8, but hey, I understood how it worked. And there's that hexadecimal thing, and people can figure that out. Heck, they can even figure out binary. So why? My system works on the number of fingers I have. Because you're a moron.
Well, you know, I think the Mayans had a base 20 system.
Well, goody for them.
Yeah, see how that worked out for them.
Yeah, well. Now, and one of the funny things is, you know, it's like the Europeans, I swear, they like to do things to be different just to be different. We have 60 hertz power. right? Have you ever stopped to wonder why our power is 60 hertz? I mean, who came up with 60 hertz? That's 60 cycles per second.
Yes.
There's a good reason for it. It's 12 times 5.
12 times 5.
And guess what? If something is divisible by 12, it's also divisible by 2, by 3, by 4, by 6. So, and now it's 50, it's also divisible by 10 and 5. So let's say I have a motor and I wind the motor. I can set it up so that instead of running 60 times per second, I can double it, the windings, and end up having it run like twice as fast or half the windings, I think it is. I don't know how it works. But basically, I can do the windings so that instead of running 60 cycles, I can have it run 30. Or I can do a third and instead of 60, it runs 20. Do that with 50 like they do in Europe. What can you do with 50? You got 5 and 2 and 10.
Huh.
And that's it.
Huh.
So, oh, I love my base 10. Your base 10 sucks.
Tell me how you really feel.
So what's grinding your gears?
So for me, it's drivers that are too courteous.
What, you got people jumping out of the car and giving you kisses at the stoplights? Because I'd be okay with that as long as they're cute.
No. What happens is that guy that's in front of you that lets everyone in front of him.
Yeah. Okay.
Everyone. So this happened to me, I don't know, about a month ago, and it's still like on my mind, like makes me so angry. on my commute home, I was behind a guy who in less than a quarter mile let 83 people in front of him.
83. Now, you didn't 83. Count.
I did count. I had my two-year-old with me and we were counting.
Oh, well, yes. So of course.
So that's why I remember it was 83.
Did you do it in the count voice?
No. Although next time I probably will.
Oh, so, yeah. So there's a certain amount of when they drive, you really have to say, this is where I'm going and not be such a milquetoast about everything. You know, you've got to say, here's where I'm going so people can plan around that. But if you sit there and, I'm just going to let everybody go, pretty much you're going to get run over.
Yeah, and because I was the first car behind him, you know, that's the guy that always gets screwed in these situations because everybody else behind you is going around him.
Right? Yes.
And
yes.
So so literally you can't like pull out and pull back in front of him because traffic, you're stopped and traffic in the left lane is going 30 miles an hour for all these people. Yes.
Oh yeah. I know just how you feel.
Oh, so angry. So, it's drivers like that that make me be a worse driver because now I won't let anyone in front of me. I just won't because I never know if you're going to be that guy.
Well, that's our show for the week, and I'd like to thank Rob Allen for our music, and thank you for listening to the Gunblog Variety Cast. Constructive criticism can be sent to Sean at seansorrentino.com and hate mail to wizardpc@gunscarstech.com. Show notes can be found at gunblogvarietycast.com/episode7. Which was That's pretty. Yeah, in computer years, in that's computer, like forever.
Yeah, that in computer years, that is pretty much at the dawn of the dinosaur.
Right. At any further back, and they're going to find it in punch cards.
Correct. Or magnetic, maybe magnetic reel to reel tapes. That's certainly a possibility.
Okay. I thought you were going to spit your water out.
Luckily, it was an ice cube.
I was like, I'm watching him. He's going to spew. No, he didn't spew.